Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
Where are you from originally, and what kind of upbringing did you have?
Would you want me to answer that with an autobiography thing that they've made up, or do you?
Yeah, I would like that.
It probably doesn't give all that you have asked. What was your question again?
Where are you from?
I was born in Melrose, New Mexico.
I would like to have that paper that your company's put up, as well as just hearing
Fine.
It quickly,
okay.
quickly from you in like two
yeah.
or 3 minutes.
Yeah. And that's what else? I was born in Melrose, New Mexico. I moved here in Los Angeles in 1917 at the age of 7 years old. First moved to San Pedro, and then probably a year later to Los Angeles.
Do you consider yourself a happy child?
Yes, I do.
You had good parents?
Yeah, yeah. I had a very good family life. Six sisters, and we were all very close together and still are. All of the sisters are alive, and I see them often.
Hmm. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a structural engineer.
Like building bridges and...
Bridges in the very early days, he was building depots for Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And then in Los Angeles, for many, many years, he was with the Thomas Haverty Company, and they put in all of the developments, the water systems and sewer systems and storm drains and that type of thing.
How did you first get your interest in entertainment industry? Was it cartoons that you had interest in at the beginning, or?
No, not really. I, more or less, it was an accident that I got into the business. In 1930, this was shortly after the crash,
I'm gonna turn that
off. I needed to... You want me to stop until you get it up?
No, let's just do that.
After the crash in 29, I quit school. In 1930, I went to work on the Pantages Theater, working with the engineers. I was not a full-fledged engineer. I never did finish my engineering course. And when that was finished, that job, I fell twice from the building and almost killed myself, and I figured I'll never make it, you know, in this
Yes.
line of work. And so there were very few jobs in 1930, and I finally found a job as a janitor in this cartoon studio. Fortunately, I had studied music and journalism in school, and I was always willing to work and work hard, and I went all through, I guess I was the janitor no more than 2 or 3 weeks, and then I moved into the painting department, and I've shot camera, and I've checked, and I've really my first big move in the cartoon industry came in about 1932 when I was working for Harmonizing Studios. That's the studio I worked for. When I started writing songs and lyrics for some of the early Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies. And then I was also able to do the timing on these.
Had you done any writing prior to that, or was that something new?
Oh, I had written, I had studied journalism in school, and I had written lots of things before, lots of poems, lots of music, mm-hmm. lots of song. This I had done, but I'd never felt as though this was any way that a person would eventually make a living.
Yes.
It was just something that I enjoyed. My whole family, I think, had a talent for writing. My mother has written a lot of published things, and so has my younger sister. And
how did that come
I
to
really,
be?
Huh?
How did that come to be? Did you come to work one day and they said, can you write?
No. What the way it happened is I would go to work in the morning and in the painting department and work all day, and then Rudolf Ising, who was one of the Harmon and Ising group, used to come in very late, like at noon, and he'd work until like midnight. Mm-hmm. And I used to go in every night and work on gags and material for him, and if he said I needed a song here, why, I would write something and submit it, and they accepted some of the things that I had written, and I did the same thing for Hugh Harmon. Hmm. And then later on, why, they let me direct pictures and time pictures, and then when the studio was taken over by MGM, I went to work for MGM, and it was there that I first met Joe in 37. And we worked together there for 2 years, and then we officially formed a partnership in 39, and have been working together constantly ever since that time.
Yeah, I have a date, 1942 is when
The date, I first met Joe in July of 1937. Mm-hmm. We worked together in story departments as a gag man and director. And in the early part of 39, Fred Quimby, who headed the shorts department at MGM, put us together as a team where we made our first Tom and Jerry cartoon, and that was, we started work on that, I think, in April of 1939. Yeah, that's the date.
I see. The dates that I have must be wrong, 'cause I have is when Fred opened up the studio and started the department was in 1942. Is that wrong?
That's wrong.
Yeah, that's wrong.
Yeah. He opened the cartoon studio in April of 1937.
Mm-hmm. And did they team you with Joe because you had kind of a good friendship going anyhow, or
no?
How did that happen?
Well, it happened one way was because I had had experience in writing the music, the lyrics, gags, stories, and was able to put it down on bar sheets, as we used then, in a musical form. Mm-hmm. And Joe was a very good artist. I was never a good artist. And he was also had a very fertile mind and lots of ideas, and so we just pooled our talents, and between the two of us, we seemed to round out a fairly good team. And
when it came down to getting together a story, let's say for a Tom and Jerry cartoon, was it just the two of you that kind of came up with the main story idea?
We were the only two then that worked on material, but we only did about six of them a year, mm-hmm. so it really didn't take that many people.
Yes.
Maybe eight cartoons a year, but we were the only two. We came up with all of the ideas, all of the gags, all of the little songs and lyrics and everything that went into them.
If I was to be a camera and film the two of you working on a Tom and Jerry, would I see two men laughing on the floor?
Mm-mm.
Or was it serious?
No, we had one desk that he worked on one side of it and I on the other. And we would we enjoyed our work, and there was lots of laughs, but there was never any rolling on the floor. Mm-hmm. But we had a lot of fun in what we did.
Now, the cartoons at that time were being turned out for the movie theaters.
That's right.
Did you ever walk into a movie theater just to see one of your cartoons?
Oh, yes.
To feel that reaction?
We used to go to preview every one of them. And we'd always go to the previews and see what happened mm-hmm. with the cartoons. No, we looked at every one of them.
Did you get the kind of responses you had hoped for?
Yes.
Was there times where they just missed out on a joke?
No, I think that they were very successful, and I think that they really did get a lot of laughs in the audience. Some of them were better than others, but they all seemed to be successful.
They say that anytime you have too many cooks in a kitchen, that things kind of turn a little sterile. Do you think that, I mean, how do you feel that the cartoons of Tom and Jerry have changed to Scooby-Doo? I mean, is it...
Well, to begin with, the restrictions placed on producing material for television is such that it is impossible to...
Well,
let yourself go and really do what you want to do.
I really should be comparing Rough and Ready with Scooby-Doo, is what I meant to compare.
Well, the business when it was Rough and Ready, cartoons for television was very new. And the networks depended upon the producers to supply the characters, the material, and deliver them a finished product. As the business grew and became more important economically to the networks, they hired program directors and people that could work with the various producing houses, such as it is now. And these people and the networks are selective in the ideas that they buy. They work very close and have approval on premises. They look at outlines. They approve those before it goes to script. They approve character models, voices. And work very closely with the producer clear through till the time the picture is finished for the screen. 15 or 20 years ago, you had none of that. We used to get an order for 32 Flintstones, mm-hmm. and they never knew what was going to happen until they got a picture. And it was during those years we had year-round employment for all of the people, and I don't think we had anyone a day out of work for the first 8 or 10 years that we were a studio. Mm-hmm. But as I say, as it became more and more important, why the networks, and rightfully so, I think, want to assure themselves that they are getting the best possible product to get the best ratings, to be that much more successful.
And be a little safer so they don't have all the PTA groups.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, action groups coming down on them.
Yes, we...
When I interviewed Faith Heckman in her office, I noticed that very day when I was there, they brought in a Popeye script, that she was actually changing the Popeye cartoon. She was changing it, and I couldn't believe that. And it's like almost changing a painting that an artist would make, you see?
Well, the business has definitely changed from when Joe and I first started.
Does that kind of
been
make you
dramatic
happy? Is
changes?
That, is it something?
No, I think that what you do is you have to adapt as you go along. In other words, for the volume that must be turned out now, for example, over on that wall are 14 different shows that were turned out this year. Now that is probably more cartoons right up there than Joe and I in our entire lifetime turned out for the theaters. Much more.
That's right.
And that's probably three or four times as much as we turned out in our entire lifetime while we were working for the theaters. Actually, there's as much probably there as we did in the first 5 years for television. And when you're only doing one or two series a year, it's very easily to work with the networks, and it's very easily to work with a small group. But when you get that many shows, why, it becomes more of a
lot of different teams.
It still must be, yes, a lot of different teams. Each network has a producer. Each network has a set of writers. And it's a very big operation. Where we started our studio with five people. Now, if you count all of the people working on this year's product, you would have over 2,000 people, between 2,000 and 3,000 people employed. Yes. And it's just a whole different bag.
Do you miss those old days of being able to look on one piece of paper and seeing what you have to do the next week?
No, because I really take what I consider as an important phase of it, and that's all that I do. And other people are doing a lot of the things that I used to do.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it's just that you adapt to a different form of production. But this has happened in motion pictures. There was an evolution there. There's been a big evolution in the way pictures are produced, live action pictures for television.
Mm-hmm.
And the networks are becoming more and more involved in producing their own or in the houses that they deal with for product. It's just a different business than it
mm-hmm.
used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have fun and we still have laughs, and I still, all of my friends are in the business, and we still go out to lunch and have as much fun as we ever did. We're none of us as young as we were, but we still have a lot of fun.
Tell me, how did the studio come to close down, MGM? I mean, it seems kind of a shame when things are so successful.
In the very early 30s, the motion picture industry was not, well, it was good. And then all through the 30s and the 40s and the war years, but when we got into the 50s, television began to make inroads on the major studios, and theater attendance fell down, and hardly any of the networks wanted anything at all to do with television. We, for the Tom and Jerry cartoons that we had made, they would take one of them and issue it, and it would be in distribution about 4 years. And let's say it would gross $100,000 in 4 years, which was very profitable. Mm-hmm. It used to be more like $200,000.
Yes.
Then they would rest the cartoon for a year. See, we had about 75 of them. Then they would reissue it, and in the next 4 years, instead of, let's say, grossing $200,000, it would gross $180,000. Now, each one of those cartoons was costing them. But then as prices went up, they would gross as much the next 4 years as they did the previous four. So those, they decided that rather than make any more, which would cost them about $40,000 apiece, they would just keep reissuing these, and then they wouldn't have to put all of that money out, which they needed for other projects. So they decided to close it down. And it was then that Joe and I did present to them the idea of making cartoons for television, which they rejected, but which Columbia picked up. And I had heard it said many years ago that one of the most serious mistakes MGM ever made was not to accept the proposal that Joe and I had made to them to make cartoons mm-hmm. for television, because Screen Gems has taken, I would say, tens of millions and probably closer to $100 million in money out of Hanna-Barbera in the last 20 years, which would have all gone to MGM.
I have a name, John Mitchell. Was he an executive?
He was one of, he was an executive for Screen Gems, but John Mitchell was not instrumental in us making our deal with him. There was a man by the name of Jerry Himes, mm-hmm. and a man by the name of Bert Hanft.
I'm and sorry, that last
Hamp, one? H-A-M-P... T, I think, Bert Hampt. And Bert Hampt and Jerry said, you make a deal with him. No, he says, Bert, you make the deal with him. Anyway, we sat down with the two of them and put the drawings down on the floor of Bert's office, and they said, we'll take it. And so our business agent got together with them and worked out the contract, and we started with them. And I guess we're with them for about 10 years until we broke with them and went out on our own.
Mm-hmm. And you were trying to, the first cartoons for television were about $2,700. Is that a right figure?
Per cartoon? I have forgotten what that early figure was.
You tried to get the cheapest package that anyone could offer.
Yes, we tried. We tried to produce them for as little as we could. Mm-hmm. And we tried to get as much for them as we could.
I can only go so far in my child's memory, but it seemed to me that the Rough and Ready's were almost a better quality than the latter ones. Am I right there?
The latter Rough and Ready's?
No, I mean, the first Rough and Ready seemed to be a better quality than let's say Huckleberry Hound or Quick Draw McGraw. Was it a different kind of style, or?
No, I.
Am I wrong?
I think that you are wrong. I think that Rough and Ready were the absolute minimum as far as animation is
really
concerned. And I think that there has been a steady change as we have gone on. The networks have demanded more and more and more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And we have given more and more. And I think today you are seeing on the screen
just with the
a quality of animation far superior to that was on the screen 20 years ago.
Now, is part of that some kind of computer machine that you have here now, or is it just
no,
using the same
you're
skills?
Using the same people, the same skills. Uh-huh. New people have been trained, but your cartoons, instead of costing let's say $1,000 a minute or $800 a minute, are costing more like $10,000 a minute.
Commercials are kind of a different story, aren't they?
Well, commercials are far more expensive than that, but I'm just talking about the entertainment portion of it. But the costs have multiplied tenfold since we first started.
Forgive me if I jump around a bit, but can you tell me how Rough and Ready came to be as characters?
Well,
did you say you needed another Tom and Jerry type?
This is basically it, we used Rough and Ready. They were friends, and we always had to come up with a different villain for them. And
one was dumber than the other.
But it's true, we just had to come up with some new characters.
When you had, you say you started your company with what, 5-6 people, you said?
Yeah.
Well, what is it like? Did you have the backing? Did you say, let's go and look for a good guy who can make some music?
No.
How did you go about building your company to begin with? Did you have certain people in mind that you pulled off of MGM staff?
Well, MGM, as you recall, was closed, and the cartoon industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Other studios were closing, and there was a lot of very talented people on the market. We started out with very, very few people. Like I say, 5 of us started.
Yeah.
And as we needed inkers and painters, while we naturally hired those that had worked for us at MGM. So in the early years, we built our entire staff out of ex-employees from MGM.
Mm-hmm.
And
we used a lot. Nichols and Alex Levy.
Lovey, they came many years later.
Mm-hmm.
Many years later.
Art Scott later too.
Much later, yeah. Yes, in the early days, it was Joe and I were doing all of the writing, the storyboards, mm-hmm. the directing, the timing. And we probably did that for the first 4 or 5 years. And I think after about 6 or 7 years is when Nick came in. Alex Lovey came in later than that, and Art Scott later than that. There might be an occasional job that Art might have done for us, but Nick didn't come to us until Disney was closing down most of his theatrical unit. Alex came to us, I think, from Walter Lantz. And I've forgotten where Art came from.
I knew he was with Bob Clampett for a while.
Yeah, he's worked at many places. He's been with us steady for a number of years now.
I heard he was working on Popeye for a while also.
Yes, he was.
I hope this doesn't tend to bore you too much, but here is a list that I got out of Variety. If you could kind of go down that list and mention perhaps some of your favorite characters, or maybe if you can tell me a description of these characters as if you were going.
I'd like to make a copy of this before you go.
Well, you don't have it?
No.
Well, I'll tell you, I saved the original Variety in its intact form. I'll give you that if you'd like it. I'm surprised you don't have a copy of that.
78, 76, no. Going down this list.
Yeah, you don't have to mention everyone, but some of the more successful
ones. Huck Hound and...
How did Huck Hound come to be? Was that working
with the
Dawes?
Voice, with Dawes, yeah. He had this voice and... We decided it sounded like a hound dog, and mm-hmm. so we made a hound dog.
That's simple.
Quick Draw McGraw, Yogi Bear I like very much. Flintstones, of course, have been very popular.
If you can,
I liked all of these early ones.
Yeah, if you can, well, sure, those were the best, I feel. Of course, I was a child then.
Yeah, you were. Yeah. All of these early ones were done for, basically for Kellogg's. Huck Hahn, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw. Geez, there's so many that aren't here. See, you don't have, like in Huck, you had Pixie and Dixie, and
yes.
Augie Doggy, Doggy Daddy, Quick Draw. Yogi Bear, Jesus, McGill, no.
You know, Ranger Smith and Boo Boo Bear. And
yeah, but there were some other cartoons that went in the Huck Hound show,
oh,
and others that went in the Quick Draw show, and others that went in the Yogi Bear show that aren't mentioned here.
Well, if you have a master list that I could get a copy of, I'd... See, I, in my book, I'm because you have done so many things with children's television. This looks awfully thick here, but when it really, when it's cut down, it'll be a different, it'll be much
yeah,
less
well,
than
this
that.
Was, there's a lot that aren't on here.
But I would like to print a complete master list, because I hope my book will be a reference guide as well as a pleasure trip through the past of television. And of course, I'm sure that list there is not complete. You know, that was printed a few years ago, so.
Yes, this is quite a while ago. Well, I would still go back and say that Yogi and Huck are kind of my favorites. The Flintstones, of course.
The
Honeymooners.
Yes.
I used to sit and laugh at that till my eyeglasses would fill up with tears. And Joe and I talked and said that we should come up with something. And we did try a number of things, and it. We had those guys dressed in all kinds of costumes. It wasn't until we put on the caveman costumes that they really came to life, and we lost a lot of money on that show.
Wait, did it not go over, or?
No, it went over very well. We spent too much on it.
I see.
But I liked most of the shows that you have here. Those are a few of my favorites.
You mentioned that with the Flintstones that you were going through a number of different costumes and periods of time. Do you remember some of the other possibilities that you had?
Oh, we had them dressed as Romans. We had them dressed as pilgrims. We had them dressed as Indians. We tried everything.
Mm-hmm.
Contemporary.
With almost the same Fred Flintstone
No,
face.
Different characters.
I see.
And then a fellow by the name of Dan Gordon came up with these costumes, and the bird with the long beak playing the record.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this was his sketch, and this is what sold the idea of the Flintstones.
Henry Corden, or
yeah,
is that his name? I understand he passed away. Did you feel
no,
that?
No. It was Alan Reed
Alan
that
Reed,
passed away,
me,
and Henry Corden has taken his place.
I see. Tell me about Alan Reed. Did you know that there was there any anticipation of his death, or was it sudden?
No, we knew that he had been sick for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
No, we knew he had been sick for a long time.
It's kind of morbid to think of this, but did you already have a replacement in mind, or
no, because
did the character settle for a while after that?
No, the character didn't really settle. There has been in recent years a tendency on the part of the networks to review back over cartoon characters that were established and that were successful and casting them in new roles now. And last year we tried for the first time in probably 15 years a nighttime presentation of the Flintstones in a Christmas special. And I think that it carried its time slot up against some tough composition.
That's
competition.
Pretty much when it originally aired too, wasn't it? In the evening when the first show?
Yes, it was, a nighttime show. And then we had another one this past Easter that was very successful. We have two more nighttime specials in work. And it might even be time to try and sell the networks on coming out with another nighttime series of the Flintstones.
That'd be great.
I think that it's time that it
everyone loves it
was
it.
Done, yeah.
When I ask people, because I just ask my friends and people that I meet, you know, when they hear that I'm doing a book, you know, I say, well, what's your favorite cartoon character? And usually it's Fred Flintstone or Top Cat, usually one of yours.
I like Top Cat. That was a funny show. We did one show on here that had some great scripts on it, but the production values were not very good, called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
Oh, yes. It's still on, isn't it? Or was it just
I think
on?
It's on syndication.
Yes. Tell me about Top Cat. Do you remember at all how that developed?
That was developed as a nighttime show.
Because when I say how it was developed, I mean, how did that come to be?
We were looking for another nighttime show. And he was the first Fonzie-type character on TV. Remember how he dominated his gang of alley cats? And the cop that they used to outsmart, it's kind of like a Hogan's Heroes thing. No, that was a very early series that has been copied many times since in live action.
That was certainly, I feel, one of my favorites. I'm surprised I don't see it on her.
I don't know where that is. It's probably in syndication someplace.
I have some other clippings that are extensions of that. Tell me about your music department. Do you have one person that you've used through the years, or?
No, we have used many people. Joe and I have worked a lot on the music. I find myself devoting a lot of my time to mostly the lyrics on the thing. Hoyt Curtin has done a lot of the melodies. I have worked on a lot of the melodies on the main titles.
I remember you told me you had done some things for Hugh Harmon, was it? Merry Melodies?
Yeah.
Tell me, do you know off the top of your head some of the songs that you've...
I really think one of the first ones that I had written was we were doing a kind of a musical thing on the Three Little Monkeys, Hear No Evil, See No Evil, Speak No Evil. And I wrote a little song for the three monkeys. And it was used thematically throughout the whole picture. They did a little dance to it. I've forgotten the cartoon, but that goes back to about 1931, I guess. 32.
And tell me about some of the ones with this company here. some of the...
Well, practically all of the main titles I have written lyrics. I've written music to a lot of them, and...
I find that fascinating.
I have worked with Joe on a lot of stuff, and I've worked with Hoyt on a lot of stuff.
I think people tend to think that, you know, you pay a lot of people to take a lot of credit, you know, and it's neat to hear that you had some...
No, I've always been a worker. I even all of this year, I did timing on pictures, which I did in 1930,
yes.
Same type of thing. Yeah, and I find myself doing exactly the same thing I did when Joe and I went into business, or what I did at MGM.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still doing the same kind of work.
Just give me one example of one song.
Well, the first one that I ever wrote, if I can remember, hear no evil, speak no evil. What is it? Hear, speak no evil, hear no evil, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, no, we're the goody-goody monkeys everywhere we go. Never have we gone astray, don't believe in being gay, being good's the only thing we know. So, speak no evil, hear no evil, see no evil, no, not a single wild oat will we sow. We're so very, very good, if we could. Hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil, no, something like that.
Yeah,
it went.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was about the first one that I can remember that went into a cartoon.
Remember those cartoons always had a lot of daisies?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that it was, yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
You still see them now and then, if you keep your eye.
Yes. God, you'd never see that one. That one's too old.
Well, see, we're lucky.
Well, that's 50 years old.
I'm lucky now because I feel that the cartoons that they're showing on Channel 11 and 13 in the afternoons are, of course, you know, far more superior than the ones that would be made today, because I'm just a nostalgia buff. That's why I appreciate the old ones. And I at times have two TVs set up so I can look at both of them, or tape a certain song. I've taped a lot of those.
Yeah.
What do they call them? Something. I remember there was some symphony, something.
Silly symphonies.
Yeah.
Old Disney stuff.
I haven't seen that, but I remember that somewhere in my head.
He used to make silly symphonies.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I saw.
We used to make Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies.
Mickey Mouse Club. Maybe I saw it.
Could be.
But I'm really looking for more of some of the recent things that you've done with Hanna-Barbera Company. You know, did you do any of the Top Cat songs or?
Yes, I wrote the main title to the Top Cat song. I did the main title to the Yogi Bear cartoons.
Do you have those theme
the Flintstones
songs? The theme songs. Written down at all?
Sheet music on all of them.
Well, yeah, I'd like to print the theme songs, because I think
all of them.
Well, we couldn't do all of them, but I'm talking about.
You might pick out
some of the ones that you were your favorites.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Because people, like, I remember bits and pieces. You know, Top Cat, yeah, da da, and that was almost like. Flintstones.
That's Flintstones. Yeah. Top Cat, ba da di da do do, ba ba.
That's right.
The undisputed leader of the gang. I've forgotten how that goes.
Rough and ready, da 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 da.
That's right. Yeah.
Da 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 da. Yeah, those are great songs that I'd like to kind of print up if I could.
I'll have to get those from out of our archives. They're buried down in the music room, but. Copies of them are available.
Your archives must be a huge building, I take.
Yeah, there's an awful lot in it. Of course, you accumulate so much and then you throw it away.
I was on a It Takes All Kinds program on CBS last Christmas, and I had these toys of television that they wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually made a call down here. This is before I started this project. And I made a call down here asking if the studio had any kind of memorabilia, you know, of cartoon characters, you know, maybe a little Top Cat or something that I could borrow to show on this special. And I went to Bob Clampett. He provided me with some things, and Walter Lance gave me a bunch of Woody Woodpecker things that he's been saving. But they said that they used to have a display here in the lobby. But
we used to have a room filled with it.
Yeah, but then it was cleared away.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to all those things?
Jesus,
Are they all in the archive pile?
No, they're probably given to some hospital, to some kids or something like that. We've sent tons of stuff to the Crippled Children's Society.
But your home is kind of clear of those kind of things?
There might be a few little things there.
You know,
I was robbed 3 or 4 times. The last time they cleaned me out of most of my memoirs or the memorabilia or whatever you want to call it, and it was stolen.
Out of your home?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
They robbed Fritz Freeling right at his office.
Is that right?
Yeah, they came in his office and took things.
Here
you have a little better stronghold.
Yeah. And we have guards at the entrances, and we have a system, you know.
Tell me about some of the other projects. I know you've dabbled in parks. Can you tell me about that?
Well, actually, we sold our company to Taft Broadcasting. It's been about 11 or 12 years ago now. And
how did that decision come to be?
Well,
were you kind of forced to? Or?
No, we weren't forced to. We just decided that we wanted to sell it and take some money, which we did. And it is Taft that has developed the parks.
Mm-hmm.
And they utilize the characters that we create in their parks. But it was really Taft Broadcasting that developed the park situation.
That was something that you probably would not have done.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. We wouldn't have had the money to do it. Those parks cost $70-80 million a piece to build.
When is King's Island?
King's Island, King's Dominion, Carowinds, Marineland.
Mm-hmm. Marineland is the latest.
Yeah. But we couldn't have afforded any of that. We might have borrowed the money and.
Now, how have those park situations worked? I know that you had trouble with one, didn't you? Didn't one take a dive? One of the parks, or was that something that the Crofts did?
Crofts did a park thing in down south that went bankrupt. Yeah, that was a Croft project.
I got mixed up in my head. Which,
that was
I know
Croft.
You've been involved with them at times. Like, did they build your banana splits?
They have built costumes for us in the past.
Things.
What
made you kind of turn to that live action, you know, the things like the Crofts were doing? Was it competing?
No, I think that
it's strange to me, you see, because
just another area. Joe has been more involved in the live action than I have. Mm-hmm. I have stayed more or less involved in the cartoon end of it. I don't understand live action at all. I don't understand how it works. It's a medium that is strange to me, and Joe has gained a lot of experience in it through the years, but I have never involved myself in it. I've felt to me more comfortable in the cartoon area that that I understand.
About picking out voices. Now, did you do a Three Stooges cartoon at one time?
Yes.
And you used the original Three Stooges?
No, never did.
Never did?
No.
There were voice people to imitate
That's right,
them?
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
That is right.
Now, you see, I have an encyclopedia of television and the prints that they did their own voices.
Well, that might have been for a different series.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.